Okay, so hopefully you ate food, or if you wanted to, and then you've had a little bit of time to think about the kinds of the kinds of experiments that you might be interested in running. Advice that I would broadly give is don't make it too big, right? You're not going to have a whole lot of time. And then don't try to bite off too hard of a problem, right? You can tackle interesting problems, but don't try to solve the whole problem all at once. Pick something small and tangible that you can get some experience with. And then as you do more experiments in the future, you'll have that practice under your belt, right? Because it does take some time to get used to how to do this stuff. So.
What? And then we're not laughing at you. She's just signing up some more nails for this course. So.
It's fine if you were. That's okay. I see. Okay, so the next thing I want to go through, since today is kind of the day that we're going to talk about historical evidence, this afternoon what I want to go through is evidence past 1900 especially. Now, I'm leaving out a lot of stuff. What is this? Oh, you're just pulling it up. Cool. Sounds good. We'll have to send the links around or something. Yeah. What I want to get across is that before the 20th century, it feels to me, at least in reading the history, that a lot of the innovations that took place were them inventing methodological conventions. And at the same time, scientists becoming increasingly more skeptical of sort of subjective ideas. That sort of happened over a long period of time. It wasn't very fast. When you think about it, the Nuremberg Salt Test, which was kind of like a randomized controlled trial, but not quite, was 1834, right? But it clearly didn't have much influence, right? Almost none. I mean, if the NHS out of the UK right now only got rid of homeopathy a couple years ago, it clearly had effectively no influence, right? And there's been lots of studies on that since. So if the story of the 19th and 20th century up before was really about methodological conventions, and again, I'm leaving out a ton, the story of the century past is really about the struggle in how science should impact people in public policy, in my view. A lot of the conventions that we have established over the last century are in some cases kind of obvious. But on the other hand, there's this tension. Oh, by the way, did you get my glasses? They were up there too. Oh, correct. Cool.
I was just thinking that. I thought I left them up there too.
They were up there.
Yeah. And that'll look great on the tape. Did you get my glasses? Yeah. In any case, so one of the weird things about the 20th century is a lot of stuff happened very quickly to a degree, but a lot of stuff that it feels like it should have happened before happened. And you'll kind of get what I mean, I think. So there were some changes in experimental procedure and methodology. Obviously, experiments today are vastly different than they were in 1834. On the other hand, a lot of the actual core methodologies are not different. They're just structured differently, they're controlled in different ways, and stuff like that. But we did also see, by the 50s, the birth of what we now call the randomized controlled trial. And if you read the literature on this, people will certainly disagree what it means, what it is. So I'm going to take you through the history so you can see what it actually was, how it's developed, and what it has sort of come to mean in the 21st century. Because this has changed not only what it means in terms of what an experiment is. In addition, it's also changed the law. Because in some cases, the design of experiments has actually impacted the law. Sounds weird, but it's true. So I've told you or mentioned before that this issue of fraud was a considerable problem. And methodologies certainly existed by the mid-19th century to combat fraud. We knew how to do it as scientists. Scientists could directly test claims and at least sort of get in the ballpark of showing them to be true or false. technically, there was lots of problems in the way they were doing it. Like, we didn't have statistics yet. There was all sorts of issues. However, if you made a claim, scientists had sort of a procedure now that they could kind of follow to sort of prove it right or wrong-ish, right? The problem was corporations often did not care, right? If they had a drug and they wanted to put something in it that was not healthy for you, they did not even have to declare that. In addition, if they had a drug and it was just flatly unsafe, it didn't matter. So the fact that scientists could disprove whether something was safe or not didn't matter if a company was hell-bent on selling you an unsafe drug anyway, right? Like, you know, imagine like a company that says, I'm going to put cocaine in this pill. I don't have to legally tell you what's in it, and I'm going to spend $1 billion in marketing to say that it's safe and to say that it's effective. That's what, the numbers are wrong, but that's effectively what was happening. Until 1902 and 1906. In those first two things, at least in the United States, and trust me, I have no idea what how this changed in Russia or Finland or other countries, but at least in the United States, by 1902 and 1906, Congress passed two acts, the Biological Control Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act of the time. And what they basically did, they said, hey, you have to say what's in a drug if you're going to sell it. From my perspective, it's crazy that that happened only in 1906, right? Like, you would think that that would have happened earlier. But when you really think about it, there's probably some reasons for it. Like, chemistry was advancing, we were getting better at knowing what things were, or whatever reason. But for whatever reason it is, that happened in the very early 20th century. And despite that, in 1938, it wasn't until 1938 that Congress decided that if you were to sell a drug, you had to check to see if it was safe. And I don't have the story on the slides, but I'll just tell you really quickly. The reason for that was because there was a company that made a drug, and that drug had some nasty chemicals in it that they called an antibiotic, right? And it did, in fact, kill bacteria in the same sense that if you shoot a petri dish with a nuke, it would kill the bacteria. The problem was, by taking their drug, it also killed you, right? And something like 100 people died, and many of them were children. And so people started sending letters to, I think it was FDR at the time, and he would get letters that basically said, my child was murdered by this company, and blah, blah, blah. And you might say to yourself, oh my God, that's awful. And of course it is. However, the story gets worse. And so the CEO basically gets called into Congress, and they're like, your drug kills people. And he basically said, I don't give a shit. And he was not liable and suffered no consequences. Because they claimed to think it was safe. And that was enough. They claimed to think it was safe. And that was sufficient to put it on the market, and therefore, they were off the hook. They did pay a small fine because they mislabeled some minor thing, but it's irrelevant. And of course, the CEO didn't say exactly that. The CEO was mildly more political, but very mildly. We thought it was safe, I swear, trust me, that sort of stuff. But we're not liable, so pound sand. In any case, that ended up making it so that now companies had to check for safety. Now think about that for a second. All of a sudden, think about what this changed. By 1938, it was no longer the case that companies could legally not use science. They had to use some kind of a scientific method with a control group and check, will this harm people in some capacity? It's interesting, right? Now it's not an academic argument. Now it's an academic argument at first, and now it's the law. It has to be done. And so science also becomes in more demand. You need to hire scientists because someone has to know how to do this. And it also implies someone's checking to make sure that you're not lying, at least to a degree. It was highly flawed in 1938 for a ton of reasons, but that's not really the point. In fact, if you ever go back and read all the discussions amongst people at the FDA at the time, which is what that started, They're basically like, how do we do this? What do we do? I have no idea. It's complicated. In any case, it forced companies to state what was in their meds, decide what the rules should be in prescribing drugs, and they tried not to limit the freedom of doctors, which was kind of a mistake, but that's what they did. And then in 1938, things had to be tested for safety. To be clear, your drugs did not have to work. That was okay if you were committing fraud. That was allowed. But they had to at least be non-harmful. Right? Now you can see how something like homeopathy can slip past the radar. Technically, it doesn't work. It's water, basically. But water is safe, and therefore you can sell it and claim that it's a miracle cure. Right? So that's how you get past the radar. It's ridiculous, but it is what it is. Okay, and the thing was, part of the reason, not just the law, but part of the reason why this was happening at the time is because scholars at the time did not trust their generation's science. Right? In the same way that I'm trying to provide some amount of skepticism about language design, scholars at that time did not trust their generation's science. And so there's a couple quotations that I think were really interesting. One scholar said, "We cannot blame manufacturing chemists for finding new things or advertising them as cleverly as possible. That they and the Nostrum inventor, like fake medicine basically, are surprisingly successful in selling their wares is largely our fault." And in effect, what he's saying is, okay, yeah, these guys are fraudsters, but we allow them to be fraudsters. Why do we do that? Which is why they wanted to have the law changed. Another on the 1906 law was, "Unfortunately, however, the physician's training is likely to be such that he cannot distinguish the rank fraud from the efficacious remedy, honestly made and sold." So answer me this, and it's a similar situation today. By show of hands, how many believe that the average software developer can actually tell which aspects of language design are easier or harder to use for the average person? How many people think that that's probably true? How many think they probably can't? And how many think that like it would be hard to be able to do that? Honestly, even though I'm an expert in this area, I'm not even sure I could do that. But I really doubt that the average software engineer could do that. But I could be wrong. In any case, they were saying the same thing about medical doctors. They're clearly experts, but that doesn't mean if they get an arbitrary drug off the shelf, they know whether it's safe or helpful. So, but by 1918, before the formulation of the FDA, again, a little bit American-centric, so I apologize for that, but I just don't know the history everywhere. One of the big issues that they were having in science was that although they could test things, scientists were also getting inconsistent results. They weren't comparing their results to each other. There was a lack of standardization. So there was an institution at the time called the Rockefeller Institute, which I think became a university. I forget which one. Rockefeller University? I'm not sure. In any case, they funded a lot of medical studies. And there's a nice quotation about it. It says, "Even at the well-endowed Rockefeller Institute, it proved difficult to allow each investigator control over the resources desired for coordinated laboratory and clinical studies of new treatments, et cetera, et cetera." Basically, what they're saying is, here's a really rich, wealthy institution trying to standardize how they do stuff. And even they are unable to do so. There was not good procedures in science to make our studies consistent with each other. Now again, if we bring this back to language design, almost none of the major studies that are done today, including my own, are done across multiple research groups and standardized. In fact, I think the answer is none of them. But I could be wrong. There are a few people that have tried it in computer science education, but in PL, I think the answer is zero. Software engineering, there might be a few, but I'm not sure. It's at least very rare. So some scientists started to change this. Probably one of the most famous on this regard is a guy named John Stokes. Have you heard of John Stokes? Okay, well, he worked on syphilis, which is an STD. And he didn't. Stokes' contribution, at least in this context, wasn't really like the details of the disease That part's a little bit icky, but that's not really what's important. What Stokes argued for was called the cooperative research trial. Basically, it took the lessons of the Nuremberg salt test. It took, like, you know, randomization, controls, blinding, placebo, stuff like that. And it added on a method for standardization, which, as it turns out, did not work at all. But it put the idea in people's heads. And notably, it had a couple key components. Number one, selection procedures. Which the first time we've seen that was actually in James Lynn's studies. He actually describes his selection procedures at length, but it never caught on for like five centuries or something, four centuries. Selection procedures are things like, if you're going to do a study on people, which people are you studying? That matters a lot, right? If you're studying people in programming language design, are you studying experienced C++ developers with 25 years of experience? Are you studying six-year-olds with none? The difference is significant, to say the least. And so selection procedures is basically saying that if you're going to conduct experiments, you need to be really explicit about who you're conducting experiments with. The next is classification procedures. This is not quite as relevant in computer science, I don't think, but this is like, if you have syphilis, how do you know it's really syphilis? That sort of stuff. In computer science, like, if it's C++, you do need to know which version, but I think that's kind of clear. Treatment procedures, again, not quite as relevant, although the way that you would translate this into our field is basically like, if you have a methodology, you got to write it down and make like a checklist, that sort of stuff. And then patient evaluation procedures, which are what the name implies. It sounds dumb, right? It kind of does. All it is just like saying, hey, let's make a list of what we did so somebody else can follow it. That's really all it is. However, people didn't do that before 1918 and before John Stokes. And crucially, Stokes said that every hospital that they were working with had to do it the same way. And this was like very controversial. It was very controversial because doctors would say things like, and I've read some of the correspondence, they'd say things like, well, I know what's better for my patients. And to a degree, you can kind of understand, right? Because it's like, they go, they see a patient, and they're like, well, crap, I can see their particular condition. I'm not going to just follow your procedure if it sucks. I'm going to do what's best for them. And so what happened was, a lot of the trials that Stokes did would basically be thrown away, because they couldn't be effectively standardized, no matter the fact that he wanted to. And that wouldn't change until around World War II. And I do have a little bit about that, but I'm going to leave off some of the especially yucky stuff, because this was a bad time in science. And I don't just mean the Germans. I also mean the Americans, who were horrible in this period, committed some serious atrocities, especially in Guatemala, in the quote-unquote name of science, but we'll get into that later, maybe another time. By the way, I do say that on the slide, and that's what I'm referencing. There's something called the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, the Guatemala Syphilis Experiment, and the Terry Hout Prison Experiments. These are all fascinating. I've read about them in great length. They're not pretty. If you want to know the details of the period, there you go. You at least know that you can look it up. Standardization, interestingly, around after World War II, there was quite a few soldiers that were dying from various conditions, and things like antibiotics were starting to come on the market. You know, real ones, right? Not these crazy CEOs that are killing people with all the ones. And President Roosevelt actually started what they called the Office of Scientific Research and Development in 1941. So that's before the war ended. And they had a couple goals. Conduct reliable studies. It's weird today thinking of Congress asking scientists to conduct reliable studies, because it's like not what our Congress does today, but whatever. Protect soldiers during wartime. Incentivize scientists to follow standard procedures through government grants. And this one right here, this government grant idea, that's really important. So the idea was this. John Stokes and his ilk were having trouble getting people to follow along and to do the same thing. So what the government thought to do is, let's bribe them. right? Literally that. Let's bribe the scientists, get them to follow standard procedures, call it a day. And you know what? It worked. Ish. There's lots of problems. Most of them are ethical. They killed a bunch of people in Guatemala in horrible, horrible, horrible ways. But eventually, the ethics issues were solved. Ish, for the most part. Not to dismiss it. But even after doing this, the John Maloney, the groups that he was helping fund or working with, they say about half the data from the studies on penicillin had to be tossed because of inconsistent procedures. And think about that. Now all of a sudden, we've gone from Reuter and von Hoven just disagree with each other, and like maybe somebody could do an experiment if they want, but there's no rules or restrictions. You don't have to say what's in your drug. So all of a sudden, by 1941, you had rigorous procedures in place. You had to follow them. You got paid by the government to follow them exactly. And there was some rigor there. But now you can see the difference between something like programming language research, which might have a mathematical proof for like a math idea. But then where are we at in terms of, if we only have 22 studies overall, we're not even talking about how do we organize them and standardize them and do anything like that. So we're really behind. We're more like 1890s or something.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I still don't understand. What is the difference between synthetization and the equivalence of your study? So synthetization means that other researchers can understand what are you doing. But it's like some rules and... possibility to understand. But is it standardization also mean like you have standard rules, that official rules or not?
That was sort of what the debate was. What does standardization mean around this time period? So your question is very relevant, right? So like that's kind of what Stokes' innovation was, trying to figure out what that meant. And if you go look at the original stuff Stokes wrote, he would just be like, if you have this kind of a patient, you're going to do these things in this order, that sort of stuff. So it was kind of prescriptive. And so they would actually argue that it's diminishing the freedom of a doctor, which it was, right, explicitly. But that was on purpose, right? That was Stokes' goal. So standardization is actually a complicated question. It can mean a bunch of things, and it's changed over, like, the last 60 years. So I think, let me get to what do we call evidence standards, which is at the end of the lecture, and that'll give you a sense of what standardization is today, and it will also give you a sense then of like how it kind of changed over time. Because there's a couple experiments you'll see where this kind of debate comes back in. So in other words, at this time, standardization was like an attempt to get people to follow the same procedures in order, but it wasn't very successful. Yeah. Okay, now by the 30s especially, but especially in 1950, we finally got to what we now call the randomized controlled trial. Here's the thing. There's this guy, his name is Austin Bradford Hill, and he had a colleague named Richard Dahl, and technically he'd done some studies before this. But how many of you have heard the claim that smoking causes cancer? How many of you heard that claim? How many of you believe that claim? Okay, now, have any of you heard smoking is correlated with cancer? Why do we say smoking causes cancer, not smoking is correlated with cancer? Why? Say what?
It's like propaganda.
No, not at all.
There is many cases around us where smoking having lung cancer. Doctor saying the reason is just this.
Yeah, but how do we know that it's the cause?
People with different conditions and having cancer.
Yeah, that's true. But how do we know that it's not something else, like the pollution in the air or like something else?
Statistically speaking.
Yeah, but statistically, you can only get correlations, really, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you know that it's the cause? Because like, you've all heard this, right? You raise your hands. Smoking causes cancer. It's not correlated with cancer. It causes it. How do we know that? The answer is we know it because Austin Bradford Hill figured out a way to do that. He found a way to test causality. And that's the key point with a randomized controlled trial. trial. It's not that you have a control group. It's not that you randomized. It's not that you have blinding. It's not that you have standardization. It's not that it's government funded. It's not that it's a grant. It goes for causality. With me? Okay, so let's talk about that. This particular study, and if you've never read it, and you have some time tonight, I strongly recommend Googling it, finding it, and reading it. So if you want to write it down, you can. It's not very long, and it's not very hard to read. I mean, there's some weird words in it, like almoners. Almoners is like a person that does interviews. But they called it an almoner for, I don't know what that means, but like it's something like that. In any case, the interesting thing with Bradford Hill was that he had learned all of the lessons from these various kinds of studies in the past, standardization, Nuremberg Salt stuff, all that kind of stuff. He had also learned about Fisher-style statistics, how to do p-values, how to do certain kinds of tests. And he'd also learned, although I didn't put it in the slides, he'd also learned about the concepts of field studies, which really comes from, do any of you watch Game of Thrones? Yeah, maybe you've heard of Jon Snow? Okay, well, it turns out the guy that invented field studies was named Jon Snow, because that just makes me laugh. And he didn't know nothing, oddly. Sorry. I'm a computer scientist, that's the best joke you get. But in any case, we often call those epidemiological studies or field studies. That's what the medical community often calls them. And Bradford Hill was really clever in that he combined these approaches to rule out alternative explanations. So if you go read this paper on smoking causing cancer, really what he does is he says, okay, well, the real world is tricky, and there's a lot of things that can impact what's going on. So he tracked people very carefully. He interviewed them, got their history. He checked their locations. He checked what kind of smoking they did, under what conditions it was, how much they did it. And then he quantified anything he could think of. Anything he could think of for understanding the relationship between cancer and smoking. For example, there were some theories at the time that it was predominantly men that got cancer for smoking. Turns out, no, it wasn't. And the reason was because men just smoked more. And you can rule that out by checking it. There was the other theories at the time that it was your location. Turns out, no, it's not what you smoke. It turned out there was other theories too. And there's a big list. The paper is just filled with all these little claims that people make about what the cause might be. And in a way, that matters a lot because there's a powerful industry around smoking. And as such, you have to be very careful because you're going up against well-funded people. So as a scientist, you kind of need to get closer to causality. And ironically, this technique, the randomized controlled trial, is often like, it's weird. Like sometimes in computer science, scholars say really bizarre things about it. Like there's one scholar that I won't name that always calls these A-B tests. These are not A-B tests. Randomized controlled trials are a very complicated procedure that try to get at causality. They're not just comparing two things. It's not what they are. So besides that, the point is that he gathered data in a bunch of different ways. Oh, and he had standardization, like John Stokes, amongst how everything is put together. And if I recall, they used any kind of money they could to pay almoners to do it consistently, these interviewers. So you can see how it's each of these individual lessons put together, and that as a whole makes up what we call the randomized controlled trial. Some field study techniques, some controls, some blinding if you can, randomization if possible, and then they link it all together and then use statistics to rule out alternative explanations. Now, ironically, Bradford Hill's study actually showed evidence that smoking caused cancer, and Ronald Fisher, the person that invented statistics, or some of the most important innovations in it, didn't believe Bradford Hill's result. And ironically, Fisher was getting paid as a consultant for the smoking industry, so he had a vested interest. And ironically, he was also a smoker. Bradford Hill's study showed evidence that Fisher would likely die of a particular condition. Fisher told him he was wrong and wrote a long paper about how he was wrong, and then he died of the exact condition that Bradford Hill's study suggested he would die from. Which is kind of sad, but yet also kind of fun. And actually, ironically, Fisher's paper wasn't even really that wrong. And people ended up going on later and trying to find all the different things Fisher said, and they piece by piece cut it apart, try to figure out whether those were causes too, and they were all wrong. But we didn't know whether they were wrong yet. They've done twin studies, I mean, crazy stuff to try to get out these other causes. But this is the key that to the randomized controlled trial. All of a sudden, you've got scientists that are trying to take a baseline, and then they're all trying to get at different pieces of it to know the answer, as opposed to just doing a one-off test as an individual. All of a sudden, everybody's going for the same kind of gunning for certain things, checking out causal mechanisms. That's the key difference. You kind of get it? Okay. It's a little tricky. This paper was so influential that it caused a literal revolution in science. So much so that the randomized controlled trial started going up in the literature, the number of them, by 11.2% per year for like 50 years. Which is nuts. Now, that doesn't mean they all cited his paper, right? But that's not the point. The point was, the medical community had gotten the message. You combine a series of techniques and you root out causality. That's the key. And if you do that, you can start to rule out alternative explanations, which means you can start to get closer to like an understanding of what's going on. We do not have anything remotely close to this in computer science, not even remotely on the same planet as the Bradford Hill approach. But we should, because it's better for all the reasons I'm mentioning it. In any case, you started seeing collaboration agreements amongst research institutions. It already had strong anti-fraud procedures built in. And you could use field or lab data. It didn't really matter, so long as you were trying to get out these root causes and get rid of them. Right? It had to be rigorous and specific enough that you can do that, but it still allowed for different methodologies to be used. That's sort of the key. And again, like I said, if you have time this week, I recommend reading the paper. Just so you've seen one paper that like fits the bill of like from that period because it was so influential. Literally exponential growth in the techniques over a half a century. I mean, what a contribution to the literature, right? We could all be so lucky as scholars. Now, okay, that sounds great. We've solved the problem. But as it turns out, while this made a huge impact, scientists by the 60s and 70s started doing, they were using the Bradford Hill approach, right? They were doing all the same stuff that Bradford Hill says that we should, but more, not just that, but that build on Stokes, that build on Bradford Hill, that build on John Snow, that build on the salt test, all these kind of things. But by the 60s or 70s, forget when this test exactly was, the funding agencies in the United States were decided they wanted to use these procedures and provide an exemplar to the community on how to do a study right. And that led to what are called the tolbutamide trials, which were an absolute disaster. And here's what happened. The scientists at the time, they had learned all these lessons. They absolutely used the correct procedures. They did the right thing. But there was a problem. So here was the idea. There was a drug, it's called tolbutamide. And basically what it was considered like an alternative to insulin for diabetics patients. Alternative. And so instead of taking your insulin, which requires a shot, if you can take it as a pill and it works, then that's good. Problem was, it had been studied in sort of small doses, like in small little trials, and we didn't have a definitive trial. So funding agencies were like, let's do a multi-collaborative thing, like in the Bradford Hill model. And let's give it a shot. So they did. Problem was, after like a certain length of time in the study, they discovered that people in the tolbutamide group were dying. And here's the problem. They were using statistics to measure this, and there was a strong signal-to-noise ratio. In other words, it was statistically significant technically, but really small. And the researchers had a conundrum. They were like, well, it looks like tolbutamide might be killing people. However, we're not sure. What do we do? And so the question was, do we stop the experiment or not? So let me stop here for just a second and ask you. Imagine you were in the shoes of this group. You have a drug. You've distributed it to a lot of people. You get a statistical result that's on the edge of statistical significance, just barely reliable at best. It might be noise, and you're not sure. And the drug has serious consequences if you do. Would you stop the experiment or not? What do you think? Somebody raise their hand. Just give me your opinion. What do you think? Would you stop the drug or not?
Stop.
Okay, what do you think?
Like, from a moral point of view, stop, but probably it's difficult to understand the situation they were in, so probably they would continue and probably so would have I.
Yeah? Who would say stop, by show of hands?
How many people died so far?
That's a good question. I should know the answer to that, but I don't. I'd have to look it up. But imagine that the statistics are telling you you're not even sure if it's real. It could be random chance. It's on the border. Like, it looks real, but you're not sure. So it could be zero, or it could be a nominal number. That's what they weren't sure about, because it's on the border of statistical significance. In other words, Fisher-style statistics, which we haven't really talked about much yet, we'll do that tomorrow. Or maybe that's experimental design. Anyway.
Well, what if I answer and that editing goes?
Say that again.
Editing goes. Because my view on ethics is that one cannot conclude on ethical issues because all choices in ethics are somehow.
I'm not sure I follow the argument.
If it's your choice, it's your decision.
Yeah. In other words, the government's saying you must make a decision, continue or not.
Yeah, but if my argument is that there is no right decision, then my argument is that I can pick whatever.
I know, and I'm saying, which one would you pick? Well, I mean, it's the death of people, though, so the doctors definitely didn't consider it that way.
Yeah, but I can say that I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, they cared. I care. I mean, it's like people dying. Like, it's a really serious thing. So, but that's the conundrum. In any case, this was not an easy decision, but the researchers chose to stop the study, right? And they were roundly criticized for this decision. And of course, they would have been roundly criticized had they continued the study too. But they then went on to make some really stupid decisions. For example, they started advertising the study heavily, even though it never finished. They started holding congressional committee hearings about tolbutamide to try to get it off the market, even though the study never finished. So they're now in this tough spot. They have an unfinished study that they don't plan to finish. You can't replicate it anymore because you can't get ethics approval to run it. And yet, the data is really unclear as to whether or not it's a problem. In addition to that, within the next few years, this study was so controversial, such a massive, nasty spot, that other researchers got the raw data and redid all the analysis. Some of it was wrong. And on top of that, even though it was wrong, they still had this effect of it being possibly killing people. However, they found it in the experimental groups, they did randomly. However, in the tolbutamide group, by pure chance, that group had to happen to have higher issues of heart conditions. And now the community is like apoplectic, because they're like, ugh, what do we do? Should this drug be on the market or not? And it's not clear. In any case, this particular study has been debated for literally decades in the literature. It has lots of flaws, but it also led to some changes in the design of experiments that are really important. Notably, it forced people to think about the issue of public policy in relation to experiments. That's number one. And number two, it forced people to think about something that we have today in other fields like medicine and education called evidence standards. And these things basically allow a certain amount of additional standardization on the Stokes model, but much, much more advanced. All right, and so here's some examples of the kind of things that change from this, one of which is eventually the Food and Drug Administration started categorizing studies. And this matters a whole lot. We also don't have anything remotely like this in computer science, in any area of it, to my knowledge. And it works kind of like this. They said, okay, these studies like tolbutamide, they were highly flawed, but part of the problem was they started doing it at scale before they'd done enough of their homework. So why don't we instead, whenever people submit to academic journals, there's a process you go through where you have to go through certain phases of experiments before you can get to trials like that. The idea being, let's try to root out the problems in experiments before they're run at scale. And it's the same thing, reason I argued earlier today why my lab does something like the doubling rule, right? Where you're like, let's test it with one person, let's test it with two, let's test it with four and eight. It's because we're trying to rule out alternative explanations before we get into the actual experiment, where we're looking for what the answer is. The FDA does the same thing. So it starts with theory, or what they call theory. In computer science, sometimes you hear this word, theory. It means something completely different. In this, it means they have an idea, a hypothesis. In computer science, sometimes they mean it to be an explanation, but that's not what the FDA means. They think it's like a plausible explanation-ish, but it's not based on evidence. Necessarily. And then there's phase one trials, which is modeling, exploratory trials, definitive trials, and long-term implementation. Phase one trials are things like, let's check for safety. And they have to be small, 20 to 80 people. Now, those aren't hard numbers. I don't know if like you had 81 if they'll cut you off, but like you get the point. And this makes sense. If you're testing something like tolbutamide, you won't actually see the effect at that sample size, but you also don't want to test a new experimental drug on too many people to the point where you can't do additional testing. So you want to start small in case that effect exists. Exploratory trials, now you're starting to look for, is there an effect, right? Does this drug actually help people, or this treatment actually help people? Does this programming language feature actually help people? Right. A definitive trial doesn't mean that we know the answer. A definitive trial by FDA standards really means something more like, this is a trial that's enough sized that we can now put this drug on the market. And then a phase four is long-term implementation means like, now we're checking in the field. Are there other problems that we didn't notice that weren't at scale? You know, Tylenol is now being used by 100 million people, are there additional effects we didn't observe? Now, think about this. We've talked before about things like standards committees on programming language boards, like C++ or JavaScript. Wouldn't it make more sense to follow a similar model? If you want to add a feature that could potentially impact $100 billion worth of productivity, shouldn't it be checked in a lab first? And then if that makes sense and it's actually effective, shouldn't it then be checked on a larger group of people and then a larger group of people before it's deployed worldwide? To me, it makes sense. I don't run the committees, though. Do you get the idea? Okay. Now, while these kind of categories were coming about, there was one other innovation in the 21st century that's sort of really important. And that is another lesson from the tolbutamide trials, but also just generally you saw sort of percolating in the 70s and 80s in the writings of people in fields that use evidence. Scientists were increasingly concerned that they couldn't compare their work to each other. This is exactly the same debate as Stokes, right? It's not any different. I mean, we'd heard this since 1918 at the Rockefeller Institute. So this wasn't a fast change for over 70 years. But by 1990, there was a group of doctors that actually went to, I think, someplace in Canada. And their goal was kind of bonkers, but they then, once they got there, they kind of changed it, and they decided that they were going to try to come up with a standard way to report trials. Originally, they were thinking it would do something like try to evaluate how good an experiment was, but they eventually came to the conclusion, how do you do that? Right, which is true. How do you do that? It's not easy. So what they did instead, they made something that became what is called consort. And this is the name that you should know, consort. Consort is basically just a checklist for writing an academic paper. That's it. However, the checklist is really specific. And when you write a paper, it tells you what you write. So all of a sudden, it's very prescriptive. It says, thou shalt have a section on demographics, and it shall be section 3.2, basically. But think about it. Now, if you go to a PubMed article that uses the consort standard, anytime you're reading it, if you want to find the demographics, you know where to look. And you know that it's reported in the study, whereas it may not have been before, because a reviewer may or may not check it. Did you have a question?
The idea of standardization. When you standardize, you might get benefit, but there's the issue that you might sort of block scientists from seeing other things outside of the world.
Yeah, that is true, actually, I think. I don't know exactly what Kuhn said on it. I don't remember reading it in one of his books, but that debate did occur in the sciences. Say what? Oh. Yeah, you said Kuhn, so that's, I thought. Oh, okay. I've only read one of Kuhn's books. I forget which one, the famous one. What one is it? Structure of Scientific Revolutions or something. I don't recall him mentioning it, but he might have. But I haven't read Firebrand, so. Yeah, like, I don't think that consort would be valid for a philosophy paper, right? It would make no sense. Because it's just not the purpose. It's just for a different purpose. However, what if you have 10 or 15 researchers all studying a particular drug? Then all of a sudden, you want to be able to compare them. Otherwise, it's very difficult. So, in any case, by the early 90s, they'd been debating this issue for 70 years. Right? 70 years. And finally, the standardization people won-ish. And there became, over time, a slow sea change, saying that even though it reduces our freedom as scientists, the benefits of being able to compare each other's work are too high to ignore. Basically the idea. So they developed this thing called consort, and the best part about it, which I think to me is just so amazing, it's really simple. And so when we're doing our little studies, guess what we're going to do? We're going to basically follow it. And I've also put in the folder an example of a computer science paper that I wrote in consort format, just so you can see one that's for computer science, not for medicine, right? Because it is a little hard to figure out how that would change. And ironically, there are some things about consort that we can't do in computer science, in part because our reviewing procedures at journals are too weak, which is ironic, but academic journals in computer science don't have a feature called two-phase reviewing, which medical journals and consort journals have, which prevents a certain kind of fraud that we can't detect. So actually, some of our authors might be committing fraud in this way, but we wouldn't know. In any case, that's not the point. So far as I know, this has now been endorsed by ballpark 600 medical journals, the consort standard, and that means you can compare across all of them, which is a huge win in a way. In addition, this standardizes the way science is reported across generations of scientists. So if you want to compare your work not just to your neighbor, but to someone that wrote a paper 30 years ago, you can now, in theory. This has only been around since 1990, but that's still a long time, almost 30 years. So the scientists at the time, this is really the argument they made. They're like, hey, look, we want to be able to compare not just to our friends, we want to be able to compare to the next generation of scholars. We're doing this for them, not for us. We may not benefit from it right now, but others will. And that link right there on the bottom is a direct link to a one in computer science format. To my knowledge, it's the only paper written in consort format, and it's not even out yet, so.
But it's going to be published as consort format.
Yes.
It's not a rewrite or something else.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it has a couple pieces in consort we couldn't do because of ICER's limitations. Now, you might also say, well, maybe they should have just stopped there. Cool, we've got standards. But they didn't. At this point, to my knowledge, they've actually run 50 empirical studies on whether or not this actually helps science. So not only do they have all these crazy procedures, not only do they have randomized controlled trials, not only do they standardize their reporting, they run studies on whether or not their study procedures are actually helping. And it turns out the answer is yes. They are. There's a large-scale meta-study, which is just a study of studies, on whether what the impact is. One of the reviews evaluated 16,604 studies in making the claim about consort. 16,604 compared to 22, right? And compared whether it improved reporting, and it definitively does. You get the idea. Evidence standards improve reporting in empirical studies, which makes sense because they're so simple. They're just a checklist of what you put in the study. So, of course, it's easier to understand. It's a bloody checklist. It's not complicated, right? Put your demographics, put this. I'll mention very briefly that I've kind of talked about medicine and I've left out a whole bunch of stuff, but actually, other disciplines are also adopting evidence standards, and this is also changing in the law. Notably, at least in the United States in 2002, weirdly, the Bush administration put in a evidence standard into the field of education called the What Works Clearinghouse. It has flaws, but that's not the point. And that became a different kind of standard of evidence. It's very different than consort. And inferior, in my opinion, but still interesting and has good ideas. But because they're educational studies, not the randomized controlled trial that the medical community uses, they allow for different kinds of procedures that we, and that in the medical community, they would not really allow. And you can argue that that's good or bad, but that's what it is. And they also have other ideas. Like, for example, reviewer certification, which I think is really fascinating. In computer science, if I want to go review for a journal and I know nothing, that's okay. In theory, the editor should check, but there's no requirement to do so. In the What Works Clearinghouse, you actually have to get training in empirical studies in order to review those kinds of empirical studies. So, to put it more plainly, if I was reading a journal article in computer science and I didn't know what a randomized controlled trial was, that's okay. I can still review one. In the field of education now, by law, if it goes into the What Works Clearinghouse, someone that is reviewing a randomized controlled trial or some other technique must know what that is, which seems like common sense. But that's the rule. There's all sorts of other stuff, too. It's education-focused. It's actually only relevant to the United States. because of the way the law is written. But nonetheless, the idea is there and can be copied in any other country. It's a good idea. And finally, while I'm talking about the law and boring you all, while I'm talking about the law, in the medical field, we've talked about how you have to have evidence for certain kinds of things. And we've talked about how in computer science, it's money, not lives, often. Well, in education, it's also not lives, right? But why does that matter? What impact would changes in public policies you have for education, just very briefly? Can you think of anything? If an entire country changes a policy for education, what impact does that have? What do you think? If I have a policy that says kids have to learn A, that does what? Or has to learn a certain style?
I think parents won't be happy because it's a new thing and they didn't experience that.
They might not experience that, yeah. So the idea is that what we're exploring house, it's not medicine where lives are necessarily at stake, but the point is if the federal government is going to say all the schools must do X, that should be based on evidence. And so in 2015, the Obama administration changed the law again, related to the What Works Clearing House, and added tiers of evidence. So the Department of Education, by law, if it funds government studies, they have to follow certain rules and take a wild guess what methodology you have to win the biggest grants. Randomized controlled trials that cover causality.
What about when there does not exist like one side?
Do you mean like where scholars disagree?
Or that you have like evidence to different directions and none of them is particle better or worse. It's a matter of taste.
I don't know if they necessarily believe in that idea, the taste. Right? Like if the evidence shows that there's two different directions, that wouldn't be a matter of taste. That would show that the evidence is in disagreement. So there are procedures.
I don't know about
That's correct.
Yeah. So there are systematic ways of dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. And also there's rules about it in the tier of evidence standard. For a tier 3 top evidence standard result to be funded by the government, there actually can't be... They phrase the rule funny. It's like there can't be disagreement or something like that. But, of course, in practice, there might be disagreement.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Right logics or not? So is it those logics that you studied, for example, in the university, or is something strange that you can't understand?
Yeah, so that would be considered a tier 0 evidence standard by WWC. So what that means is let's suppose you're trying to get, because this is about getting money, right? This is about getting money from the government, mm-hmm. and that money impacting public policy for kids across, millions of children, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is this. If you have an idea that you just have some thinking about, then you can apply for a grant under tier 0 saying you have no evidence. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be evaluated exactly like you're saying. Mm-hmm. They'll think through your logic and decide whether they like it. But the problem is, they don't fund it very much on purpose. And number two, it can't impact policy because they don't want it to just be somebody's thought that impacts, 100 million kids. They want it to be thought plus data. So that's the idea. In other words, you can do it, but the impact that it has is lessened on purpose because before it gets deployed across an entire nation, they want some more rigorous evidence attached to it.
But it will, my question was more close to the situation when you are a reviewer and you need to read the article or research and you don't know this field so well. And you try to understand the logic of authors and to try to understand is it clear or not?
Yeah, for WWC, you actually have to go through training in order to do it. So you couldn't really understand it without that, too, because it's very complex. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, they have very specific statistical tests that have to be run and standardized, mm-hmm. and they are not simple at all. So it's basically experts only. There's no real room at first.
That's why you need to be, have this certification.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are lots of venues that you can publish in that have nothing to do with the WWC. Mm-hmm. But that's for money, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the difference of government grants versus, like, I have an idea, mm-hmm. right? And there's always room for just publishing ideas, and that's okay. Okay, so here's an example of the checklist, so you can just kind of see what it is. So as I'm trying to say, this is not very scary. It's very simple. For example, thou shalt have a section called 1A, called Title and Abstract. Mm-hmm. Right? Not exactly scary. Background and objectives, where you say, like, what's the background of the study? I mean, like, not exactly crazy. Methods, the design of your trial, the number of participants that you have. What are the interventions that you put in? What were the outcomes of the study? So, I mean, like, it's all obvious, but the point is everybody's reporting it in the same way. Right? Sample size, randomization, you get the idea. Not that scary, right? It sounds scary, but it's not that scary. Or am I wrong? Scary? Not scary? I'm bored. Okay, that's fine. And I won't belabor this, but if you go onto the consort site, you can see exactly how these mappings are done for examples and stuff. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, what parts contribute to removing the researcher's bias towards, like, being selective on the study?
I don't totally follow.
Well, I was just, like, thinking that if the researcher puts in bias, he wants to make a study that supports his claim, then what are the parts in this that go against that or remove it?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So bias is always tricky with studies, not just studies, just anything, philosophy, whatever. People can have agendas, politics, etc., right? However, the whole idea of running studies is that it forces you to have checks and balances. So, for example, let's suppose you were running a study about a particular idea that you had and you wanted to cheat, right? What you could do is you could not randomly assign your sample and instead assign all the good people to the group you care about and all the crappy people to the group you don't, right? You could do that, but it would not pass the evidence standard. So it basically enforces a minimum bar of checks and balances. That's really what it's for. But remember, too, that whenever you're writing a paper, it has to go through peer review. So that means if it doesn't match the evidence standard, it still has to pass peer review. And peer review is, you know, has its pros and cons. It's not terribly reliable, but it exists, and it's better than nothing, I would think. So there's no perfect answer to the issue of bias, but the whole idea of all these experimental procedures is to try to remove certain kinds of fraud and bias. That is the point of them. It's just that they're not perfect, right? You can still have an agenda, or you can just flat out lie, right? Like, just make up data, claim it was randomized and it wasn't. I mean, there's no real stopping some stuff. But on the other hand, as scientists, you know, we can't check for everything. We have to set reasonable boundaries about what's possible for us to investigate. And so detecting lies is sometimes pretty hard, I would think.
Yeah, I think one of the points here is that you are forced to lie.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
You can't, you know, insinuate lie.
Yeah, that's right. You have to say what your position was, and if you're not being truthful, you know, that's it.
It could be a criminal offense.
I don't know. Actually, and it has happened, right? Do you know the story of Andrew Wakefield? You know this guy? It's actually kind of crazy. You know the anti-vax movement we sort of mentioned with the inoculation? This is the guy that started the modern equivalent of the anti-vax movement. Basically, he went to a hospital and he claimed, supposedly, or allegedly, I guess I should say, that these kids got autism from the vaccines. But in fact, he got caught later, a reporter investigated, and he just flat out made up the data. He literally just said, yep, he got autism, and he got this thing, and that was that. It's just completely not true. And so it's stunning that, like, that was his agenda. It's an example of bias or flat-out fraud, but boy, would that have been hard to detect, right? Because he was saying in his journal articles, I have the records from the hospital, and here they are, blah, 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 and they were just flat-out fraud. But it is what it is. That's hard to stop. There are other examples of it, too. There was a company in 2003, I think, that basically they ran tons and tons and tons of studies, and then some of them were actually killing people. But they forgot to mention those, and then they found one where they found a minor effect, and they published that one. And they got caught because they killed people. And that set off this thing today called trial registration that we won't get into. It's part of Consort, if you really want to know. Okay, now, there's one other discussion I want to have before we get into our main discussion of continuing with our experiments. And this one is a little bit tricky, but I want to discuss it as a group anyway. The same thing, small groups, and then go on. And that is, in the 20th and 21st century, what we've observed is that there was an interplay between the law and the discipline of science. And the reason for this is because of the impact of science. Science has tremendous impact on lives. It fixes our medical conditions. It causes impacts on our education system. It's expensive for software to be built. All these things matter a great deal. And so, my question is this. Given the laws of your country, whichever one that happens to be, and that'll be interesting to hear about just because I don't really know what they are for all of you, what changes to the law could plausibly, positively impact computer science? Not just in terms of experimentation, but also in terms of that. In other words, we have these things about software being expensive. Should changes to the law occur, and if so, what? What would do no harm but positively impact people? So let's spend 5 minutes, talk about it in your groups, and then we'll call out again.
So you mean like extending the law to
I mean, maybe, if you think that's interesting, but you might have other ideas too, and I don't know what they are. So. But yes, that's plausible. We could have laws for evidence about software, but it might be too early for our discipline too, I'm not sure.
Go to the easier software, or just more information. One problem that I perceive is that some people think that software is soft.
Yeah, I read an article and I think it was Symmetrical.
My robot is.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact name. One of those things are themselves. Okay, 1 minute.
Causes errors.
No idea? Okay, I'll tell you one thing I do. Think about two particular things. In Europe, they added the GDPR, There's also the 737 MAX. Boeing had a plane called the 737 MAX. It crashed twice, killing 300 people. This was in the last year or two. Europe then said you can't fly here anymore. And then eventually in the United States, they said you can't fly here either. And then it came out that a couple things had happened. One is Boeing had basically hired out the software to like some Indian team and number two, they got the regulations changed so that they could self-regulate their software and then it would be a software button. And so it's complicated, but nonetheless. Maybe that's the one, or other ideas like also be just like Yeah, in any case, I put this question up not because I think it has certain answers, but I want you to think about it because, like, you as individuals have the right to lobby your own governments wherever you live to make changes. So the question is, what should it be in the 21st century? And they might be related to evidence in some things, but they might be related to other things. Just trying to get you to think about it. Yeah, see, that's exactly the point, too, is that, like, this forces you to say, well, what are they now? And then once you say, what are they now, you can say, well, wait a minute, do they make sense? In any case. Okay, let's go ahead and stop. Okay, so just one sentence call out, and we'll see if you came up with any ideas. So as I was just saying to this group, part of the purpose of this exercise is to give you, to get you to do a couple things. Number one, realize that there are laws right now related to computer science, right? There's a bunch of them. Europe has its own. The United States has different ones. I think Europe's are a little bit stronger than ours right at the moment, but they're different.
So that's number one. And number two, I want you to realize that a lot of the impact science has had is by changing the law. And it's possible that things have to change in computer science too. And so I want you to be aware that this progress that's happened in experimentation happened not because scientists just wrote a paper. It's just not what happened. What happened was they wrote lots of papers and then they lobbied for change. That's the key. And I just want you to recognize that that's part of the game. It's not just about sitting in your office and talking to other academics. Sometimes you have to talk to politicians. Sometimes you have to talk to other people. And so I'm trying to encourage you not to become politically active or not, but I'm trying to get you to think about that because it's really important. So if you want the work to have impact, impact. In any case, so what did you come up with over here?
Not much.
Not much. That's right. I think I stole you at the end, so that's partly my fault. So. Okay, then why don't we go to your group? Did you come up with anything?
We're not sure we really grasped the idea of this question or topic, but we did play with the idea of having like government run testing facility or other authority to watch over
Interesting. Okay. What about your group?
Well, I thought that there exists evidence that like errors in software development can lead to like a catastrophe such as a spatial explosion or delay of large software projects and it costs a lot of money for investors and blah, blah, blah. The evidence might suggest that certain languages are worse than others, or certain constructs in which language are more error prone than some others. So then based on this evidence, one could make like last suggestions that sort of try to hold through the old case. But like minimize the use of those things that have shown to cause that.
So process type stuff. What were you going to say?
I have only one wondering. Why this question popped up after this experience of health and biological experience you showed before? Why it comes at this time?
This question?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure. What do you mean?
What you're expecting for me. I think I would rather compare that programming language design with fashions.
With fashions?
Yeah. Because it's about people taste. If it fits me as a programmer, I will go with this, regardless what you say. If you tell me go on with 0-1 programming, and I think it's beneficial more, it's not time consuming, it helps me more flexible, I will go with it, regardless you say or not.
Well, just to be clear, I'm not telling you to do anything.
I mean, not you yourself. Yeah. I mean, generally, if whatever authority will tell me this is beneficial or not, I will never follow just their saying. I have to test it myself, experience, and see how it will.
Well, hold on. Let me push back just a little bit, respectfully.
Okay.
The point isn't about trying to get a government or something to mandate how we program. That's weird, right? That's not the point. The point is to ask ourselves, how does public policy impact evidence, right? So, like, in medicine, for example, the idea that a company that wants to sell a drug should test for safety seems reasonable, right? Wouldn't you agree? Yeah. And so, like, if you're making a programming language product, I don't know that they necessarily mandate what people use, but what if they said, what if the ISO board was lobbied so that when they put changes into C++ that they gather data? That seems pretty reasonable to me, right? It wouldn't impact you necessarily as a programmer. You could still do what you want or use it or not. But it would mean that when they make changes, they have to bring something to the table, right? So don't think about it in the perspective of we're all going to go mandate what each other does. That's not really what that means. What we're talking about is how do we make change at scale so that there's slow improvement over time? Like, to me, I think the one that's probably the most beneficial would probably be getting the boards, like the ECMAScript board and the ISO boards, to have a data gathering procedure as part of their board, right? That would probably be beneficial.
I'm not the right person who can give or share with his experience. I do only scientific programming with old Fortran, MATLAB, and currently just Python.
Sure.
But from this limited experience, I can see that MATLAB versions, I don't know what the point about it. Every year there's a new version, but I don't think it's beneficial in any way. Maybe we have to tell these people, if you don't bring something new, then stop this plan. They are paying. I don't know what the difference between these versions. Maybe this is one point you can consider. Like, if you will code something new or come up with whatever you code, you have to make crucial changes. It should be beneficial somehow. Otherwise, we have to stop it or not to buy the new version. Maybe this is one point.
For MATLAB specifically, I'm not sure, but well, why don't we take your group as well? Did you come up with anything?
Well, we were talking about labs and then not directly about programming languages, but then about law, like if someone is planning to do like medical whatever program or whatever, or the national safety or trains, airplanes, whatever program, they should like be heavily expected to test their programs and then to have to prove that they really have tested those before those are really like going public to hospitals and whatever places.
Mm.
So that's kind of law to protect that. And then you mentioned this, like if someone changes in the language, and then of course you have to always develop those programs. You have to prove like those changes in the languages doesn't affect the old program in some weird way. So those, the testing part and the proofing part, in a way, should be more crucial, like demanded.
Mm. Interesting. So you're thinking like safety critical stuff, and then basically anything that has at scale impact should have more rules.
So if you are planning like little games and those are important, I like playing, but like those which are just not going to kill you probably.
Yeah.
I mean, airplane can.
If Angry Birds crashes, I think it's going to be okay.
I will survive. It makes me sad, but I will live on. But if my airplane crashes, I
will
so
not. Yeah. What were you going to say, something?
Down to software, like if you make software for a medical facility, for example, and you have bug in it, can you blame the programming language?
Mm.
Language is basically just a tool. The software is the actual, the meaningful part of it.
It's hard to say, right? Like, what if the language has features that make it easy to make that bug? Like, they may not be legally liable.
Yeah, so I wonder, is it possible to, for example, make a law that forces companies that make such critical software to use like more secure languages? Like, if there are studies that show that C++ has more bugs, C++ code has more bugs on average than, for example, Java code, then those laws would prevent a company from using C++ for such critical stuff.
It's possible.
I think that's a very good point. Somewhat similar to what Alistair says. But I was also thinking like whether there's exist this kind of bias in thinking that it's like software is soft, it's not dangerous because it's not like electricity or chemicals. That people are like don't understand that it shouldn't be recommended as harmless.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, 300 people on the 737 MAX, I mean, that's a lot of folks. So, and it's hardly the only case where there's safety critical applications that have failed too. So, and I don't know what the regulations are in each country on software that's safety critical, but you'd think that there'd be some, but maybe there isn't. In any case, The point of the question isn't for us to all become legal experts right now, but the point is to get you to think that when science has changed, sometimes it happens because scientists provide pressure, and sometimes it's because lawyers provide pressure. And that interplay really does matter, right, in terms of impacting a society as opposed to just writing a paper for your thesis, right? There's a big difference. So, okay, so that's literally hundreds of years of evidence gathering as quickly as I could possibly squeeze it in, right? So that's like, you know, a couple hours of evidence gathering. It's not nearly enough to really understand the full context, but I hope it's enough that you get a rough idea of what's put together. Is that, you kind of get it at least? 1800s, 1900s, we're talking like, at first it was just developing methodologies, and eventually public policy, because it was having so much impact, started to getting involved. That's really the idea. And we moved towards standardization. Okay, so now at this time, what I want to do, it's the session two. We've got a couple experiments. And what you have a half hour, so the plan is this. For the next 15 minutes, what I want you to do is I want you to develop experimental tasks that you will have people do for your experiment, okay? Designing tasks is kind of hard because the easiest thing to do is kind of get a writer's block-like feeling, like, I have to have the right task. But I would encourage you to not think about it that way. Come up with a task, even if it's not perfect, because you can iterate on it later. Come up with something else. But don't just like sit and stare at it forever and try to obsess about whether it's the right one, because there is no right task. Oftentimes, you just have to try a bunch of them and see how it goes. And that's kind of the way it is. So what I'm encouraging you to do, we're going to take 15 minutes. We're going to write out some tasks for whichever your experiment is. And then we're going to share whatever details we can. I know your group might share less, and that's okay, but we're going to share some details about what we came up with, okay? Remember, our goal is by Friday, we want to be able to run the experiments with each other, get some initial data, and then do some statistics on that data, right? That's the idea. So these tests have to be sort of small and put together in order to do it. But remember, we're trying to make it factual and objective and testable, just like the kind of stuff that we see. Does that make sense? Okay, try to come up with some tasks. Small and simple is good, especially as a first cut, so give that a shot. 15 minutes. Okay. So, you want to do these together? So the question is, should we go like really cheese it out and do like multiple choice and see how we do that way? Should we do a writing task, or we have to like have a I'm not sure. We have to decide. That's kind of, we had talked about it, but that doesn't mean so. Compression, writing, still same writing. You take, the reason I say is because either way you have to have code in order. When we do test like that, we do it on a computer, which is why I say there's not a compression tests are kind of hard to write them too. I don't know if your lab was the right word. You can probably get a lab with art in general.
I feel like
I like his presentation. His advisors did a feedback analysis of the experiments. And then they found the red paper.
I've read something.
She did a big one on factor analysis with measures for many experiments. And then basically did replication and found it was all wrong. No, there's two ones. Exploratory and exploratory. But they're both actually factors. They just put the number in the or at least I can hear them. but from a compiler's perspective, but so it's possible though in Java, I mean, the use cases are different. Oftentimes you want static variables, and sometimes you want static assumptions. You want both of them. In this case, it's but I don't know if that matters. So when we did our analysis, and we were running through the compiler. What we noticed was that a lot of people were instantiating math objects. It wasn't just the math objects, but people were like mixed objects that were using using atomic static to approximate. And in addition, oftentimes when they had something like this, what they would do instead of making it and they would create a field rule so that they could do this and change it every time. So then that means that it runs to a so those are the things because then we could argue about the profile. The whole point is to discuss it, figure out what you think the consensus is. I'm fine with that. So I think that. So why don't we what if we just did something silly like how would you call sine functions?
I don't think there would be any harm.
Yeah, I guess you could. I don't even know if this is the right call, but I'm just going to put something in there. Although in Quorum, because of that result from the 90s, we made these optional, so technically, we could get rid of those. So I thought this really cool. But we actually have. I think so too. So I think maybe that one of these you also need. Yeah, and then so we have a class. Oh, that's what we have. We should have the right using of the class and also right. Well, maybe not. Or we could give them all.
Yeah.
So then well, it wouldn't be the same. I see where you're going with this. Let me write something down.
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to say something dumb, because you would just like implicitly wrap it in some sort of weird class. And then,
like, if you know, like, some of the things,
oh, what's your thing?
So, maybe, you know, this is the thing.
The other thing we could do is we could chop a group so we get more statistical power with those.
And we can make
it a conclusion.
That's
the reason behind this. Yeah, but we are.
No, I know. Do you want to test that or not?
Are you not resolved?
Yeah. All right, so we're kind of out of time. So let's write down, as best as we can, the what we want to do for tasks. And what I'd like you to do is, even though we're not going to, I'm not going to write all your tasks up here right now, that might take some time, I'd like you to save them for future days. And if you have time, clean them up so that you can kind of come back with something more fleshed out. Because if you do that, we're probably all more likely to succeed on Friday in getting something real, so you have a tangible thing you've run, right? In other words, when you leave the course, I want you to have a rough sense of how to actually do this, right? And so if you flesh it out a little bit, you're probably more likely to know how to do it, right? Does that make sense?
Honestly, after this example of how to make your experiments reasonable, I feel like handicapped, like the man who was trying to find a reasonable relation between smoking and cancer. It makes me feel handicapped thinking of whatever. I can never make it a real fact without going the same way.
I 100% understand. 100%. And this is exactly why when they started doing experiments in the early 1800s, it took so long for them to make progress. Because you feel like, holy crap, there's a million other variables that could be getting in the way. But as scientists, we got to start somewhere. And so the reason why we were able to make progress is because somebody said, I'm going to do a test even if it's flawed, and then somebody else can build on it. So it is a balance, but you're right, completely. So, yeah. Okay, so let's go around the opposite way first. So why don't we let your group go? Can you describe roughly what kind of tasks you're thinking? Where'd you get to? Okay.
The most difficult task was, it was selection. So we will have first group professionals who knows our program. It may be students or some like new professionals. And we want to give them tasks, very simple tasks, for example, to calculate, for example, mean wage of people from data. And we also will give them some instruction what is function pipe. And after this, we randomly separate this group for two groups. Into one group, we give task to calculate our task, and other group calculate our task with pipe. And we measure time. And also we want to have control group, and it's group that doesn't have. Background in program in knowledge about our program, so we give them more instruction about how examples how to calculate some mean variable, and after this gives them the same tasks, and also say them about pi function, and also randomize them for two groups, and also calculate their time. And then we will understand, is it easy to understand, and is it more fast to use pi or not, based on these two groups.
Okay, now some of you might have been like, what did she just say? But actually, what she just described is called a two-factor design, called a two-by-two design. We'll talk about it tomorrow, how you do that. And you'll refine these. That's excellent. What you just said was very good. The reason it's very good is a couple things. One, it's explicit. Number two, it's pretty simple, right? Two groups, with and without experience, with and without the pipe, have them do something tangible like calculate a mean and see how it goes. The point is, and this hits to your point, it's possible that when you actually run that test, you're going to find nothing, and that's okay. Because what you're doing in piloting is you're refining whether or not your data is going to tell you anything and whether your tasks are reasonable. So I love it. Design those tasks and get that little calculated in there to have people write it, and amongst yourselves, I would actually have each other try it and just see how it goes and see if you like the tasks. That would be a good next step for refining it. Okay, so excellent job. Behind you. Terrible idea. No, go ahead. I'm just kidding.
Well, actually, we were thinking about telling you a bit later, and we're just finding out the sort of task that will fit our plan.
Okay, so you don't really want to say. You're claiming you don't really want to say.
Yeah.
Okay, that's okay. So let's go to the next one. They're very secretive. Okay, fair enough. That's totally okay. Remember, like, oh, by the way, I mentioned it to this group after, but I didn't say it to the rest of you. One reason why they're trying to keep their stuff a little bit secret is because of something called the good subject effect. The good subject effect means if I tell you my hypothesis and you like me, you might try to help me out a little. See what I mean? And if I tell you my hypothesis and you hate me, you might try to screw me over a little bit. And this effect is well known in the literature. It's one of these things that can get in the way. So the way that you mitigate it is you don't tell people what you're studying. You don't lie to them. But you also don't tell them. And then when they get into your experiment, they just know that it's about programming in some way. So you have to be a little careful in what you reveal and what you don't. In their case, though, they revealed it. Now, the reason that's okay is because these are still pilots, right? Like, we're not going to publish this data. So it's okay. But if you want to keep it secret and give it a shot, cool. That's okay. Okay. And same with you. You're going to keep it secret as well?
Well, we still have to read your article. So we don't.
Well, trust me, we may do something stupid too. So that's okay. So it is complicated.
No, but the idea hasn't really changed. We'll just split the group into two. Get one group
Do you want to also see who can find the most errors, or is it going to be one error? I'm not sure. Not sure. There's also, I can't remember who did it. You might remember. There is some literature on how you generate errors in code. And we have another article where we did it, but I don't remember which one it was. Let me see if I can't find it. Okay, there's this. This paper, I'm just referencing my own because it's the one that comes to mind, so I'm sorry. There's probably better stuff out there for this, but this has the lead author of Per Runsen. He's a software engineer in Europe somewhere. I forget. I don't even know where he lives. Sweden? Oh, okay. Do you know Per?
I know
of him. Okay. He's a really nice guy, but Per has done a lot of stuff in software engineering, and one of the things he did this, not me, is he set up, I kind of just did stats, and he set up this way to inject bugs so that it was like fair, You could look at that paper and just use the same tasks and then use the same bugs just because it's already known, and then it might be easier. I don't know. But that's also really short. That's why I'm mentioning it. So it might save you time, is my point. So I don't know, but it's something to consider. Okay. In any case, that sounds good. And what about y'all?
Well, I think we are still a bit confused as to what we're going to do. We tried to simplify our hypothesis, but now we think it may be too obvious.
Okay. What's your hypothesis now? Okay, so there is a theory by a woman named Brianna Morrison. I'm going to put it down in the notes. I've never done studies on this, but she has, called WERT examples. And that is almost exactly what you just said. And she has a methodological procedure for testing it. There's two things, though. Number one is the data is already well known. So it might be the impact of word examples is kind of known already. However, I think she only did it in one programming language. We don't know if it varies. So that could be a control condition that you could do. But the nice thing is her methodology is pretty clear. And it's the type of thing, if you go find some worked example papers by Brianna, you might be able to adapt it very quickly. And then, like, it makes it a little easier to sort of get started. You know what I mean? So if you're interested in that particular hypothesis, realize there is some literature already, but that's not necessarily bad. But you might be able to adapt it to something a little bit more sort of language design-y, which I doubt has been done. So that might be possible. So maybe look up Brianna Morrison.
So if you were to kind of try this with multiple languages, do we also need to, like, for example, divide people into like two groups? Some gets examples, some with no examples. But like the people that get examples will get all the examples with languages, snippets with examples, and the other one gets all without. Or it should also be like.
This is actually a great question. And the answer is, it's never clear until you try it. And so oftentimes what you do when you're designing experiments is you just guess as a first step. And the reason is because you have no choice, because you don't know what will happen in the experiment. So if you guess as a first step, and let's say you do it with like two people, like literally between the three of you, you try it two different ways, just with on yourselves as a first step, and you think it's a failure, that's great, because then you know one thing you don't do. And then rewrite it again, and then try it again on two of your friends, and say, see how it goes there. You see what I mean? That way, like, even though that's an imperfect procedure, it's a lot better than nothing, and it does help. In more mature fields, there's a different procedure used. So in education or... So for example, if you're writing a Tier 3 ESSA Department of Education grant, I know that's a lot to spit out, but if you were, by law, what you have to do is if you have a hypothesis like this, you have to write a special equation called a power analysis to calculate the sample size you'll need to hit that hypothesis based on existing literature from a Tier 2 study. And so... But the reason that's possible is because there's already existing data for the same hypothesis with the same tasks. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this particular case, you have nothing to go on. So therefore, you have to make it up. Which is why in the medical fields, it took so long to get like this kind of ball rolling. It was hard for a long time. Yeah. So in other words, don't worry about it too much. Start simple and try it out. Okay. All right, so for tomorrow, we're going to move, I think it's to experimental design and R. So for those of you that wanted to start with R, we're going to start that tomorrow. And experimental design stuff is pretty crazy too, but it's not super hard to understand. There's just some buzzwords and stuff you kind of got to learn. This will allow you to change your hypotheses around and to control like how many groups you have, and it does impact how you measure it statistically. So you have to think about that carefully. So we will modify all of our experiments tomorrow. But what that means is if you have time tonight, get some basic tasks written and take a guess at the methodology so you can come in prepared for tomorrow. Is that reasonable? Yeah, I know that you might also just want to go drink beer and ignore this stuff, and that's okay too. You do what you wish. But I'm just saying, if you want to be prepared, that's what I would do if I was wanting to be prepared. Get some basic tasks written so that they're good enough, and then tomorrow we'll hammer out the methodology so that we have a good idea, do some stats, and then Thursday we'll go heavy into the stats so that we're prepared for Friday. Okay. All right. See you.